So I'd like to invite the top three abstract panelists, who are all back there for some reason, loading their slides. So as many of you know, and some of you may not, if this is the first time that you're attending the conference, each year we get a wealth of abstracts. And what we do is we make sure that each abstract is reviewed by three experts in the field, and that's one incredible role that our faculty serve at IAPAC. And every time we do that, we realize that there's a few abstracts that really score incredibly highly. And just to let you know, they're being scored on things like rigor, methodological quality, quality and clarity of presentation, soundness of the work, and as well as impact and significance. So what we like to do is to pull the top three, so the ones that are literally scoring in the highest three. In this case, it's one in biomedical or pre-exposure prophylaxis, for example. The other track that we pull from is adherence, and that can be adherence measurement, adherence intervention. And the other track that we pull from is linkage, retention, or keeping people along in the continuum of care. And we have one person that's ready to go. Let me introduce, actually, our panelists as they sprint up to this stage. There's Carol. Oh, and excuse me for one second. Okay, that's for those of us that are not like 5'7" or whatever you need to be for that. Well, we'll start with Linda Beer. Maybe we could just start. Okay, just to save some time, and I'll just introduce each person as they come up. So Linda Beer is an epidemiologist from the U.S. CDC, and she's going to be talking to us about increases in antiretroviral therapy use and viral suppression among HIV-infected young adults in the United States 2009 to 2013. Thank you. And what we'll do is, if we have time, a couple minutes, we can do some questions.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and I'm really honored to be here. Thank you for to the conference organizers and to the abstract reviewers. I'm really pleased to be able to come and share some of our work with you. So first, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and also the participants, participating facilities, the local staff and community and provider advisory boards that work on the medical monitoring project. So I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So just to provide some background that probably all of you know, most studies find that HIV-positive young adults are less likely than older adults to take ART, to be adherent, and to be virally suppressed. However, there have been recent developments in HIV care and treatment that may have had an effect on these patterns. So clinical guidelines now recommend universal prescription of ART. Simpler, more tolerable ART regimens have been developed, and there's also been enhanced focus on improving the care continuum for youth. However, the effect of these recent developments on youth nationally is not known. So informed by this, the questions that guided our analysis were, have recent developments been accompanied by increased ART prescription, adherence, and care utilization among young adults in care? And if so, has this contributed to improvements in viral suppression? And so the figure just kind of illustrates, you know, our thinking around this. ART prescription, oh, with a little N down there, sorry about that. And subsequent adherence obviously are essential for viral suppression. And engagement in high-quality medical care kind of provides the supportive underlying structure that enhances all of these relationships. So to answer our analytic questions, we estimated temporal trends in these factors among HIV-positive young adults in care in the United States from 2009 to 2013. So we analyzed data from the 2009 to 2013 data collection cycles of the Medical Monitoring Project, or MMP. MMP is a HIV surveillance system that describes clinical and behavioral characteristics of adults receiving HIV medical care in the United States. MMP produces annual cross-sectional estimates from a complex sample of patients within facilities in 23 U.S. jurisdictions. During these data collection cycles, MMP collected over 23,000 interviews and medical record abstractions, and our response rates range from 76% to 85% at the facility level and 49 to 55% at the patient level. So we use linear regression to estimate trends from 2009 to 2013 among young adults receiving HIV care, and we define young adults as those aged 18 to 24. And you can see here our N by year. Our measures of interest were all based on medical record review, except for our adherence measure, which was based on self-report. We looked at viral suppression, so less than 200 copies per milliliter at last test, sustained viral suppression, and that's all viral loads during the past 12 months, less than 200 copies. We looked at ART prescription during the past 12 months, 100% adherence to ART dose during the past 3 days, and our measure of care utilization was at least one viral load in each six-month period during the past year, and that's the year prior to the interview. All of our data were weighted for unequal selection probabilities and for non-response. So this slide shows selected characteristics of our HIV-positive young adults in care. And you can see that many of them are Black men. About 62% reported a gay or bisexual identity. 62% were living in households that were at or below the poverty level. And about one-third of young adults receiving HIV care were either uninsured or only had Ryan White HIV/AIDS program coverage. In the year prior to interview, about 14% reported being homeless and 11% reported incarceration. Most of the young adults in care were diagnosed with HIV after the age of 10, and three-quarters were had been diagnosed with HIV for less than 5 years. So this graph shows our prescription from 2009 to 2013, and we found a significant upward trend. Our prescription was 76% in 2009 and 87% in 2013, and the beta indicates that our prescription among this group increased an average of 4 percentage points per year. There you go. So now turning to ART adherence, we did not see any significant upward or downward trend in self-reported adherence. It was 79% in 2009 and 78% in 2013. Turning to care utilization, again, we saw no significant trend. It was relatively stable over the time frame, going from 74% in 2009 to 69% in 2013. So turning to viral suppression at last test, we saw no significant upward or downward trend. The percentage of young adults in care who were virally suppressed at their last test was 65% in 2009 and 65% in 2013. However, when we looked at sustained viral suppression, we did see a significant upward trend. Viral suppression among young adults in care went from 29% in 2009 and rose to 46% in 2013, a significant upward trend. It increased an average of 5 percentage points per year. So we saw no increases in viral suppression at last test, but we did see increases in viral suppression in terms of sustained viral suppression. So this graph might kind of help illustrate in a different way what we're seeing. So the bars represent the proportion of young adults in care who were virally suppressed at their last test for each of the years that we examined. Now the blue portions of the bars are those who were suppressed at their last test and then also maintained viral suppression in the entire year prior. That's the group that's increasing. the blue bar or the orange portion of the bars are people that were only suppressed at their last test. So at least one time during the prior year, they had an unsuppressed viral load. So just to quickly summarize the results, we saw improvements in ART prescription among young adults in care, a 4 percentage point average annual increase, no change in adherence or care utilization as measured by regular viral load testing. We saw no change in viral suppression at last test, but improvements in sustained viral suppression, a 5 percentage point average annual increase. So why have we seen improvements in sustained viral suppression? One thing we examined was whether increases in ART prescription contributed to this. And we did find that accounting for ART prescription somewhat attenuates the sustained viral suppression trend. And you can see the adjusted beta there. But we didn't see that same similar upward trend in viral suppression at last test. And as we saw, at any given time, only about two-thirds of young adults in care are virally suppressed. But, however, increasingly more are able to maintain that suppression over a longer time frame. So why no change in viral suppression at last test? Well, based on the factors that we examined, it could be related to the fact that we didn't see any improvements in adherence and in care utilization. Another potential explanatory factor is whether the characteristics of young adults in care changed over this time period. And we examined this. We did see a slightly increasing proportion of males among young adults in care. No other changes, but we did look at the results and stratified by gender, race, ART use, and time since diagnosis, and it did not change our results. So our analysis has some limitations, a couple I'll just mention here. First, our adherence measure is self-reported, limited to the past 3 days, and there are other ways to examine adherence that might better capture a person's actual adherence patterns. We also didn't assess many other explanatory factors for changes in viral suppression, for example, changes in ART regimens. So in conclusion, we saw significant increases in sustained viral suppression among HIV-positive young adults in care in the U.S., which may be partially attributable to increasing ART prescription. So that's good news. However, it's really important to note that levels of viral suppression among young adults in care are still way too low. They fall well short of the national HIV/AIDS strategy goal of 80%, and they are significantly lower than the levels of viral suppression we see in older adults in care. So our findings suggest that wider development and implementation of effective strategies to improve adherence among young adults may be warranted. A recent systematic review of adherence interventions among young persons found that most interventions were small pilots that needed replication. But they did suggest that there are several strategies that might be effective for improving adherence among youth. And those include a phone-based counseling approach with adherence monitors and weekly individual and family counseling. Nevertheless, the observed increases that we saw in ART prescription and sustained viral suppression among young adults are encouraging and suggest that there may be cause for optimism regarding efforts to improve outcomes for this vulnerable population. Thank you.
Right, well then I get to ask it. Sorry. Always give other people a chance. I was obviously thinking about the intervention implications there, and I guess looking at what you're looking at and what people seem to do well at and what they're not doing so well at, what's kind of your next step in terms of figuring out how to intervene in the gaps that you're seeing? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I would kind of throw it back to you and this group. I mean, surveillance data are very powerful, and they tell us how we're doing on a population level. I mean, we do have information on experiences of side effects. We have regimen information. Mm-hmm. So we definitely feel like our data will help to inform some of the strategies that you all are developing. But, you know, we still have a very global view. So, yeah.
Thank you. Excellent work. Great. Thank you. Yep. So for our next top-ranked abstract, we're going to hear from Jessica Haber, who many of you know, but she's an assistant professor at the at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School in Boston. And she's going to be talking with us about prevention effective adherence in a demonstration project of PrEP among HIV serodiscordant couples in East Africa. Thanks, Jessica.
Great. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
make sure you're still with us. And I'd like to thank the conference organizers and for the opportunity to present, and all of you for being here to hear the results. I'm very excited to present to you today on behalf of my many co-authors. So these are my declarations of funding and consultation. So I think most of you in the room already know this, but I'd like to take a few slides here just to put us all on the same page about the relationship of adherence and PrEP, PrEP efficacy. So on this slide, you see HIV protection effectiveness on the x-axis and percent adherence on the y-axis. And these are the data from the clinical trials that took place a few years ago, showing that when adherence is low, efficacy is low. And when adherence is high, efficacy is high. Very clear relationship. Looking at more recent data into demonstration projects, we're seeing similar results. So speaking about the partners demonstration project, about which I'll be giving you more data in a few minutes, this is a study in serodiscordant couples in East Africa, and adherence by drug levels was very high at 85% on average, and incidence was very low, 0.2 per 100 person years. Very similar data came out of the DEMO project, which was among MSM in the U.S., high rates of tenofovir adherence, and again, low HIV incidence. And in Project ADEPT, which was presented for several different populations, but focusing specifically on young women in South Africa, adherence was again generally high. So what I'd like to do now is think about what does PrEP adherence mean? And I'd like to contrast it with adherence for treatment and adherence within clinical trials. And for those of you who heard my presentation yesterday, this is going to be the exact same thing for the next two slides. But for the rest of you who weren't there, I'd like to review this concept of prevention effective adherence, which I published last year in AIDS along with several co-authors, including Rive. And what we did is draw the distinction between this paradigm of ART adherence and clinical trial adherence, where success is really defined as 100% adherence. There's never a time when you don't need to adhere. There's never a time when you shouldn't be taking medication in order to get clinical benefit or to show the optimal true biologic efficacy within a clinical trial. But when we switch to think about PrEP adherence outside of these clinical trials, in demonstration projects or in clinical care, we need to think about when adherence is important. And that's a real shift of how we think, because it really does matter when do people need to adhere. Is it all the time? You know, most people are not going to be taking PrEP for life, and I'm not sure that's the message that's out there in the community. And the way I've described it here, you can think about HIV exposure over time with these arrows. Okay, this is a very simple graphic, but I think you get the idea that there are discrete times when HIV protection is necessary. So let's say it's these arrows here. PrEP adherence during that period is very important. But there are periods when there's no risk, and that may be because somebody is not potentially exposed to HIV. They may not be sexually active or using drugs, or they may be using some other prevention strategy. PrEP is not the only thing out there, obviously. They could be using condoms or the ring or whatever it may be, but there's no risk in this period. So somebody's not taking PrEP. They've signed up as a PrEP user in some capacity, but they choose not to take PrEP during that time. I think that's fine. That makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. So to think about this in another way, high adherence and risk means effective protection. But when you have high adherence and no risk, what you're actually getting are potential side effects and lots of cost. And I think the cost issue is particularly important as we think about the rollout of PrEP, which has been a lot slower than I think most of us would like. And on the flip side, if you have low adherence and high risk, you get potential HIV acquisition. So that's not what we want either. We really want this top figure here where we're matching, we're aligning adherence and risk. And so to understand prevention effective adherence, you really need to be aware not only of when people are taking medications, but what is the context in which they're taking the medication. And you know, this is dynamic over time. So how can we think about this with real data? So I'm going to describe to you what we've learned through the Partners Demonstration Project. And this is an open-label study of integrated ART and PrEP delivery among just over 1,000 high-risk HIV serodiscordant couples in four sites in East Africa. And I won't go into all of the details for time, but people were screened for the study to have an estimated incidence of greater than 5%. So I know one of the previous speakers told us to not talk about high risk. But I guess I'm going to use that term a lot, so I hope that's okay. So within the type of program within the Partners Demonstration Project, HIV uninfected members of serodiscordant couples were encouraged to take PrEP for about 6 months, during which time their partner could take ART and, in theory, most likely, hopefully, become HIV or to become virally suppressed, at which point there would not be risk for HIV transmission. And this could take place immediately at enrollment or later in the study. Participants were allowed to take PrEP when they wanted or to not take it when they didn't want to do that. But that was the recommendation as this bridge strategy of going from a serodiscordant couple with risk to a serodiscordant couple without risk, either through ART for the infected partner or PrEP for the uninfected partner. And the study had 24 months of follow-up with quarterly visits and will be concluding next month. So moving on to the methods of the analysis that I'm going to show you today, I'm looking only at the first year of follow-up for individuals taking PrEP. We used MEMS caps to look at adherence. We have several other measures, but I'm going to be focusing on MEMS today. Everyone, I think, has probably seen a MEMS cap. And we are using adherence during periods of preference for PrEP. So if people told us they did not want to take PrEP, we didn't count that against them. So their adherence is only being considered when they selected to take PrEP, or they couldn't, and we didn't consider it if they couldn't take it, for instance, during a study hold for toxicity, which was very rare. We also censored a very small amount of data because of adherence that didn't really make sense and we think was a device issue. And when I'm presenting my calculations, I'm defining adherence as the average number of doses per week during the 4 weeks before a study visit, where I can give you the context of what was going on in people's lives at that time. So how am I talking about risk? You know, going back to this concept of prevention effective adherence, you need adherence and you need risk to know how they're aligning. And this could be done in many different ways, but this is how we're doing it for the purposes of this analysis. So if you think about, this is a series of Venn diagrams. If you think about the largest circle of a Venn diagram, we're defining potential risk as having an HIV-infected partner who's been on ART for less than 6 months. So this is how most of our participants, or all of our participants, entered the study. Then you can think of a somewhat smaller circle where they're reporting sex with their partner. Now, we all know that self-reported data may not be 100% accurate, but just work with me for the sake of the definition. Then we have an even higher potential for risk if people are not using condoms. So condoms being very effective when used. If they're not being used, you could consider this scenario as high risk. Now, say we take out the condom factor. Again, it may not be the most accurate. We could, I think, agree that this is a scenario of probable risk, where you're in a couple with, again, a high risk of HIV, estimated at greater than 5% incidence. And we're going to call this HIV probable risk. And then we're going to call it low risk if they say they're not having sex. Now, the other part of the definition for this analysis is what is sufficient adherence? I'm not going to claim to have that answer. I think that would be another presentation altogether. But what I'm doing for the purpose of this analysis is to look... Oops, to look at data that was published from a few other colleagues showing that in MSM, the level of sufficient adherence is probably achievable at 4 more doses per week on average. And in a more recent analysis, for women, it was estimated to be greater 6 or more doses per week. And the differences have to do with the biology of tenofovir in different tissues where exposure may be taking place. It's unclear what is needed for heterosexual men. We tend to not talk about that. I'm not really sure why. But I think we need more information there. And what I'm going to be presenting in the analysis is looking specifically at 4 more doses per week and 6 or more doses per week. So in our analysis, I'm first going to show you some descriptive data to understand what was prevention effective adherence within this study. And then I'm going to go through some regression models looking at various predictors of prevention effective adherence. And you can see all the different factors here that we looked at in our models. We did some a priori interaction assessments for gender, and we also assessed for collinearity. So just to give you some idea of who are the participants in our study, at enrollment, these are the individuals taking PrEP. Most are male, just under 30 years old, with 8 years of education. Most did not have children at the time of enrollment. Most were sexually active with their study partner, and reported sexual activity outside the partnership was relatively low, although I'm sure it was happening perhaps even more than this. And their HIV-infected partners had CD4 counts above 400 and high viral loads. So overall, what did we see? First, to start with, the initial phase of adherence is uptake or initiation, and we had very good uptake. That's probably because they wouldn't have enrolled in the study if they weren't somewhat interested in PrEP. But we were glad to see that 97% of our participants did initiate PrEP, and the vast majority initiated at enrollment. We had a few people who wanted to think about it, but almost everybody initiated at enrollment. And overall, our MEMS adherence was quite high. Looking at a median value, we saw 88%, and by mean, it was slightly lower at 78%. Okay, so this table is summarizing what prevention effective adherence was in the demonstration project. And I'll walk you through this table because it's a little bit complicated. So we're looking at a total of just over 3,000 study months. And reflecting the adherence, again, this is the average adherence per week over the entire month before a study visit. And in this first column here, we have sufficient adherence with our two assumptions of either 4 or more doses per week or 6 or more doses per week. And this column indicates the total number of visits that would apply to each of those assumptions. Then in this next set of columns, we have risk for HIV acquisition defined by those Venn diagrams that I showed you earlier. So high risk being here, probable and low. And then the number of visits and the percent of visits where people had high risk and were able to achieve sufficient adherence defined at 4 or more doses per week, those with probable risk and those with low risk. And these categories are mutually exclusive. So every individual had to be categorized as low, probable, or high based on being in the partnership without ART for 6 months, having sex with their partner, and using condoms or not. And that would define their risk. And then some comparisons. So what we're seeing here is that people who have high or probable risk, quite a high number of them are achieving at least 4 doses per week or more. And those with low risk are not quite achieving those same levels. When we go to a stricter definition of sufficient adherence, we're seeing that 72% of individuals and 70% based on high and probable risk, respectively, are achieving that higher threshold of 6 or more doses per week, and fewer where people are having low risk. So what this is telling us is that people know how to adhere when they're at risk. This is very reassuring to me. It's also showing us that achieving sufficient adherence is easier when the threshold is lower. That's also common sense, but this data supports that. Now, moving on to the second half of our analysis, which is to understand who is achieving prevention effective adherence, I'm going to show you two models. The first one is assuming sufficient adherence at 4 or more doses per week. The second will be the 6 or more doses per week. And I'm showing you just the final regression model. These factors in blue were factors associated with achieving sufficient adherence, and in red, those are factors associated with not achieving it. So individuals who reported no concerns about taking daily PrEP were more likely to have sufficient adherence. And those who were trying to be pregnant or currently pregnant within the partnership also had higher adherence. Individuals who had a partner on ART for more than 6 months had lower adherence. That's what they were advised to do, so that's not surprising. And individuals who were no longer in a couple with their study partner had lower adherence. So there may be some concept of not being at risk if their other partnerships did not involve HIV or they were not sexually active, period. I did list down here some of the other factors that were included in our regression model that did not achieve statistical significance. We'd like to highlight, though, the age of 25 years, which almost made it. But individuals who were less than 25 years of age had lower odds of getting sufficient adherence. And we did exclude a small amount of data from our analysis because of missing data. Looking at the different threshold of 6 or more doses per week, we can see there are more factors associated with achieving or not achieving that. The top category here is about being sexually active. So referent to individuals who were not having sex with their study partner, those who were, whether it was protected or not, were more likely to be to achieve sufficient adherence. Again, those who did not have concerns about daily PrEP were more likely to have sufficient adherence. This one I found very interesting, that individuals who really desperately wanted their relationship to succeed were more likely to achieve sufficient adherence. Age did make it into being significant in this model, and women were actually more likely to be adherent, which is good considering that they probably do need higher adherence. Looking here at the red factors, those who had problem alcohol use were in the study for longer periods of time, and again, those who were not still in the couple, those individuals had a harder time achieving sufficient adherence. I've listed again the factors that did not achieve statistical significance, and I also wanted to mention that we did not see any of the gender interactions that we looked for in our models. So to conclude, PrEP adherence is different than ART adherence. Again, this is probably preaching to people who very much know this already, but again, I think this is an important message, and it's exciting to be able to talk to you about it with real data, so moving beyond the concept into actual scientific research. Most people are achieving it. This is a real success. People, not only are people adhering, but they're adhering when they need to adhere, and I think that's really important. And it's also important to note that when we think about these higher levels of adherence that may be necessary for certain populations, that it is more challenging for them. So what are the implications of this work? So I think understanding these predictors can really help us in finding people for whom PrEP really makes sense. I think PrEP is an exciting new technology. It's not even that new anymore. But it's not for everybody, right? We don't want to encourage people to take PrEP if it's really not good for them. And there may be, and hopefully are, other options on the way that may make more sense for them. So who are these people for whom PrEP really, really is a good option? And what we've learned in our study is for people who are fine with taking a daily pill, PrEP makes a lot of sense. People who are aware of their risk. In this case, it means being sexually active in a serodiscordant couple, but in other populations, it may mean something else. So helping to find people who understand why they're taking this pill, what it means for them. And then that third bullet up there about the commitment to something that may be achieved through PrEP. I mean, we're always talking about risk, and I don't think a lot of people who take PrEP are always thinking in that same way. But what we saw by that predictor of wanting a relationship to succeed, it's a complex issue, but PrEP really was a way to resolve all of the discord that was going on. Well, not all of it, but a lot of the discord that was going on within the relationship. And so by taking PrEP, their relationship was able to succeed. So helping individuals who take PrEP understand what PrEP is getting them beyond just saying it lowers their risk. I think we've had several discussions about that over the last couple of days. And then finally, predictors may be helpful in targeting support. Reve, I'll preempt your question about interventions. I think trying to get people to these first set of categories could be really helpful, helping them understand why they would take PrEP and what it could mean for them. And then for those individuals who decide they want to take PrEP but are struggling with it for things like alcohol use or just being young, I think we can target interventions that way. So I'd like to conclude by thanking many, many people who made this study and this analysis possible, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Great. Really great, Jessica. We have time for a couple questions. Oh, I know that person, oh. Jane Simone.
Hi, Jane. Yeah, so I didn't, just for sake of time, I didn't go through the full protocol, but they received standard counseling that's consistent with CDC and WHO guidelines. So they were advised to take daily PrEP, and that daily PrEP was important. But they were also told that they didn't have to continue it for the full 2 years of the study. So they were encouraged to take it for that bridge period of 6 months while their partner was getting on ART. And again, that didn't always happen at enrollment. So some people were on PrEP for quite some time, or they may have wanted to continue it for other reasons. But they were given the standard counseling messages of you need to take this pretty much every day. Condoms were available. Full counseling was involved. So are you asking how they interpreted the counseling? And Guri, I'm going to put you on the spot since you were on the ground collecting a lot of this data. So the question is, what message do you think people heard about taking PrEP? You know, we talked about it being daily, but is that what the people internalized? Because it does seem that they were able to align their adherence and their risk, and it was not just a uniform understanding of, or uniform behaviors of risk. Thank you. And I think one of the important point about the type of counseling is it was really individualized for the context. The study took place in multiple sites, and I've heard really fascinating vignettes of how people describe risk and describe multiple strategies to protect against that risk, like security. You know, you don't just need a wall, you need a dog, you need a security guard, you need a lock. You know, different strategies like that. So I think the counselors have really done an outstanding job of helping people understand the messages, and I think that's reflected in our data.
So I have a question here. Sorry, thanks.
Yes.
Actually, it's a counseling question as well, because there's two sides to the counseling equation. One is the messages that were given around the using treatment, right? Because and 6 months seems like an awfully long time for people to be concerned about risk, given that ART works probably more quickly. So what kind of messages were given to people about the treatment? Were they told to still use condoms, or were they told, you know, what in terms of the time frame and these sorts of things? Because that would also influence their perception of risk as well.
Absolutely. So the time frame of 6 months was chosen looking forward to implementation, where most settings do not have viral load testing. So while it could have been shorter, I think the 6 months was just to be cautious. And people were given messages about using condoms, and I think it's always tricky. And in discussions, I think, you know, with the WHO and other groups who are creating these guidelines, like, do you give permission for people to have condomless sex? Right, that's not in the WHO.
Sorry, permission? No, nobody's giving permission. I mean, right? You know,
well,
people are having sex, but yeah.
But, you know, from a guideline perspective, you know, are you saying PrEP is fine, that's all you need? And I think that, again, we'd have to talk about individual counseling sessions.
Or treatment's fine, right?
I'm sorry?
Or
treatment's fine, absolutely.
Yeah.
Or maybe the ring or injections or any of these different modalities. And you know, then thinking about other things that need to be potentially protected against, like other STIs, or people don't want to conceive, or if they do want to conceive, there are all these different scenarios that we have to figure out how to help people work through, which are all quite complicated in some ways. And I think our challenge is to make that simple and to help people really achieve what they want. Again, getting back to why are they taking PrEP, or why are they choosing something else?
Yeah, thanks. Nice.
Yeah, and ultimately, obviously, people make their own decisions for how they're going to use things. Makes sense, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. Okay, great. And I know in the program that we had originally had David Wall coming to present the abstract. He had submitted of a randomized controlled trial of an intervention to maintain suppression of HIV viremia following prison release through the linkage to community care, and that's the IMPACT trial that Carol is also a part of. So we're lucky to have Carol Golan be able to step in to do this presentation for him. And Carol is a physician director of the Social and Behavioral Research Corps at UNC Center for AIDS Research and an associate professor in the Department of Health Behavior at the Gillings School of Global Public Health at the UNC Department of Medicine. So thank you very much, Carol.
Let's see. Ah, there we go. Okay, thank you, Reve. Good morning, everyone.
Is it still morning?
It's still a little bit more. It's still morning. It doesn't feel like it. I also want to thank the conference organizers, both for the opportunity to speak, but also just for making this great meeting happen. This is really, I think, my favorite academic meeting of all the meetings throughout the year. So I'm particularly excited to be able to present our results from IMPACT at this meeting. This Project IMPACT, as you can see, which stands for Individuals Motivating to Participate in Adherence, Care, and Treatment, is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina and Texas Christian University, and also part of the NIDA-funded Seek, Test, Treat, and Retain initiative. Let's just see if... There we go. And I do want to say before I begin that I don't have any conflicts of interest to declare. So, as all of you are aware, Jeremiah Johnson's important comments yesterday, notwithstanding, treatment as prevention, or TASP, is advocated as one tool in the armament to improve both personal and public health. By finding more people living with HIV and then engaging them in care to achieve sustained viral suppression, as essentially this entire meeting has been talking about. This multifaceted TASP approach is readily applied in prisons, where the prevalence of HIV is 3 to 5 times higher than in the general population, and also where routine HIV screening provides opportunities for both detection and then treatment because of the systems there. However, while HIV testing, free care, and antiretrovirals are commonplace in prison, many HIV-infected individuals who are released from prison don't link to community care or fulfill their prescriptions, and so are unable to maintain viral suppression after they go back to their communities. So at community reentry, as you might imagine, it's a particularly challenging period for prisoners, and a return to HIV transmission risk behaviors coupled with viral rebound can actually have the potential to create a perfect storm for transmission of HIV to others. So knowing this, it's clear that effective programs to help HIV-infected releasees maintain the health benefits of care that they experienced during incarceration are therefore an essential part not only of good care for them, but also of a broader comprehensive HIV prevention efforts. So therefore, the objectives of this study, the IMPACT Project, were first to adapt and integrate together adherence and care engagement interventions that we had previously developed to create Project IMPACT, a multi-component intervention for HIV-infected prisoners facing reentry. And then second, to compare with standard of care among HIV-positive prisoners during release the effect of Project IMPACT, specifically to see its effect on viral suppression after release. Now, conceptually, we developed the theory-based IMPACT intervention to target motivation and self-efficacy to both accessing community HIV care as well as to adhering to ART in the reentry context. By design, and this was with an eye towards sustainability, the focus of the impact intervention was linkage to an HIV care clinic, with the idea being that's where comprehensive supportive services like substance use disorder treatment, assistance with housing, these kinds of things could be provided, rather than developing an intervention that would directly provide these services. We integrated and adapted the three interventions that you see listed here. Michael Mugavero's Project Connect, which was a linkage program, the PACT Adherence Program, and CTOP, which is Cognitive Enhancement for Probationers. This was a cognitive mapping program specifically for probationers. And we then finalized the IMPACT program following formative research conducted with previously incarcerated HIV-infected individuals and community providers. And this additional formative work led to some further adaptations, which included the addition of a text messaging technology component to the intervention as well. So the final impact intervention has three main components. First, motivational interviewing, which I think most people here are familiar with, that it's an evidence-based counseling style that is very humanizing, it's non-judgmental, it meets the person where they are. And we also had accompanying videos that role-modeled preparing the releasees for the IMPACT program and also getting them prepared for the release experience, getting them to think about it ahead of time. The second component is brief link coordination. And the third component was the text message adherence reminders. So just to get a little bit more specific, the motivational interviewing sessions included two face-to-face in-prison sessions that occurred during the 8 weeks before release, and each was preceded by this preparatory impact video that we produced, and I'll show you a little clip from that in just a minute. And then there was also six phone MI sessions delivered after release over the over 12 weeks. The brief link coordination involved conducting a needs assessment before release and sending it to the clinic that the person planned to return to, scheduling a community HIV care appointment before release at that clinic so that it could take place within 5 days of release from prison. And then the link coordinators also initiated any AIDS drug or pharmaceutical assistance program paperwork on an as-needed basis. And then finally, as I mentioned, we had text messages. These were tailored to the individual and were sent before each dose of antiretroviral therapy for 12 weeks, and they were sent via cell phones that we gave to the individual's participants at the time of release. So this slide just shows you chronologically what I just described in terms of the intervention. The long diamond, you see the gray diamond there sort of in the middle, represents prison release or week zero. So you can see before release, the prisoners watch the videos, they receive two MI counseling sessions, and they meet with the link coordinator who does the needs assessment and schedules them a doctor appointment within 5 days of release. And then after release, they get their cell phone. It was a flip phone, and they received the text messages from that phone, and they're also able then to do the six phone counseling sessions over 12 weeks. And I'll just show you a little clip. Thank you.
It took a while, but can you turn it up? It work. You just got to stick to it. And the more I stuck to it, the more things worked out. And so I started believing, I can do this. And now I got me a job. It ain't no big shakes, but I got health insurance.
I ain't there yet. Right now, I'm working part-time and staying at my sister's. But I am taking some classes. And plus, I figured out a way to keep up with my meds. That's good, right? And even with all this craziness out here, I still find ways to make it to my doctor's on time.
Well, I'm back on my meds, doing everything the right way. Look, I know it's a lot to deal with out there, and I ain't gonna sugarcoat it. It's hard sometimes. Real hard. I mean, taking meds was so much easier in prison. I had to learn how to take care of me in the middle of going out and just living life again. I finally figured it out. It was me that had to do it, with some help from my impact counselor.
So, and these statements that they're making, this is just 1 minute out of a 15-minute video, but it really reflects a lot of what we heard in the formative work and focus groups and interviews. So in terms of the setting, you might have guessed the study was conducted in North Carolina and Texas, but you may not know that together this includes 1 in 7 of all incarcerated individuals in the United States. In both states, over 90% of inmates, just to give you a sense of this setting, over 90% of inmates are tested at prison entry, and HIV care, including ART, is provided to infected inmates. This is actually a federal mandate at no cost to them. Prison staff then in both states routinely perform discharge planning, and this includes referrals to clinics or other housing services, that kind of thing, but no direct scheduling of appointments for people. Both state prison systems do provide a supply of antiretroviral therapy at the time of release, but as you can see, it's not very much. In Texas, and this is per state policy, 10 days worth is given. In North Carolina, 30 days worth. So in terms of who was eligible for this study, to be eligible, as you can see, they had to be at least 18 years old, they had to speak English, they had to be incarcerated in one of the two state prison systems, have a documented HIV infection, be currently on antiretroviral therapy, and have a recent viral load of less than 400 copies per ml. They also had to be within 12 weeks of prison release. And then finally, we did exclude, for safety of our staff, individuals who had been convicted of particularly violent offenses. So to do the study, we conducted a 2-arm, 1-to-1 randomized controlled trial stratified by state. This included the standard of care arm, which was the discharge planning I mentioned, and the project impact arm, which I've described. They obviously were, that arm was also, could receive any discharge planning that was offered by the prison as well. Audio computer self assisted self-interviews were administered to assess demographic and psychosocial factors such as mental health status, substance abuse, these kinds of things. We conducted follow-up assessments at weeks 2, 6, 14, and 24 post-release, and this was done in the communities to which participants returned, which meant our staff were going all over the state, states of North Carolina and Texas, to do these assessments. And these involved blood draws for HIV viral load and also the audio computer assisted self-interview to assess self-reported health services use. And we used timeline follow back to do that and asked about different types of services that were used. And we also asked about many other factors like housing, employment, social support, other factors that I'm not going to talk about today. And finally, all participants, both intervention and controls, did receive the flip cell phone at the time of release. And this was to facilitate communication and balance retention. So our primary outcome was the proportion of participants with a plasma HIV-1 RNA level or viral load below 50 copies per mil at 24 weeks after release. So that was our primary outcome. But we also assessed the impact on several secondary outcomes. We looked at viral load at all of the other follow-up time points, 2, 6, and 14 weeks after release. We also looked at an interesting outcome because Steve Cole is involved in our project, so we had to look at viremia copy years. And that's a cumulative viral load measure over time, for those of you who aren't familiar with it. And then finally, we wanted to look at non-emergency medical care attendance, because we were targeting both adherence and clinic attendance. And we do plan future analyses to assess several additional outcomes that we measured, like adherence, et cetera, that are listed here. So our primary analysis was intent to treat, and we estimated the odds ratio and 95% confidence intervals by logistic regression models employing multiple imputation. We also conducted a secondary analysis of complete cases, and that included only those participants who had the available 24-week viral load. We also conducted sensitivity analyses, first using simple imputation of missing outcome data and also assessing our alternate HIV RNA outcomes that I mentioned. And we conducted a Kaplan-Meier analysis, a survival analysis, to assess time to first medical visit to look at that outcome. So in terms of the participants, as you can see, and we screened in the prison clinics for the most part. We screened 1,800 individuals. Of those, over 1,300 were not eligible, 73 refused. So that left 405 individuals who were randomized, and that was 206 in the intervention arm, 199 in the standard of care arm. But as you can see, 11 and 13 in the intervention and control arms, respectively, were actually post-randomization found to be ineligible, either due to extended sentencing that we became aware of after they were enrolled, or because they were noted to be a high threat risk after the fact. So that left us with 195. In the intervention arm and 186 in the standard care arm. And as you can see, from within those arms, we had quite a bit of loss to follow-up, most due to reincarceration. So within each arm, about 30 became reincarcerated and about 20 lost to follow-up, and 5 to 10 withdrew from the study. In terms of the participants, of our characteristics of our participants, as you can see, they didn't differ between the arms. Both groups, on average, were middle-aged, with nearly 80% men, around 2/3 African-American, 7% Latino, and 40% had less than a high school or equivalent degree. Their median CD4 cell count was 500, and median incarceration was 0.8 years, so not particularly long. So what did we find? This slide shows the results of our main outcome, which was the 24-week viral load, in terms of both the primary, secondary, and sensitivity analyses that we did. And as you can see, all the odds ratios are right around 1. So basically, we found no statistically significant differences in the odds of viral suppression between the impact and the standard care arms in our primary outcome using multiple imputation, complete case analysis, or simple imputation. No matter how we looked at it, we were disappointed to find no difference. Similarly, we looked at the viremia copy years shown on the bottom of the slide here as a secondary outcome, and they were essentially identical by arm. So maybe the differences, there were some differences earlier, but not sustained at 24 weeks, so we did look at these different points over time. But as you can see, the slide shows basically the proportion of participants with suppressed viral load at each of the four follow-up time points, the vertical axis showing proportion of participants, horizontal axis showing time, and you can see that both study groups experienced a steady and similar loss of pre-release viral load, with only approximately 60% in each arm having documented undetectable viral load at 24 weeks. And at any of the time points, the rates were similar, except at the six-week time point, there was a small but significant difference favoring the intervention. The other thing you may notice is that at study entry, there was a slightly greater proportion of participants in the impact arm with virologic suppression, but adjustment for this baseline difference did not meaningfully alter the findings either. And complete case analysis, I have a plot like this of the complete case analysis at each time point, and those look virtually identical as well. So this slide, finally, this slide shows you the results related to clinic attendance. The bar graph shows the proportion, as you can see, of patients in each arm who attended at least one clinic visit by 6 weeks post-release. And on the left are all non-emergency medical visits, and on the right are all HIV clinic visits specifically. And as you can see on the left, with the blue being the impact bar, 10% more individuals in the impact arm than SOC did visit a clinic within 6 weeks. But when we looked on the right at HIV clinics specifically, we did not find any difference. And then in the survival analysis, which is indicated at the bottom of the slide, the median time to first medical appointment following release was 10 days for controls and 10 days for impact and 13 days for controls. This was statistically significant, although not a huge difference. So our findings need to be interpreted in light of the study limitations. First of all, probably our biggest limitation is that the participant loss to follow-up was pretty large, largely driven by reincarceration. It was 33%, although it was similar in each arm. Also, the cell phones that we provided to participants in both arms, and we did this to minimize the risk of imbalance in study retention, but it could have facilitated clinical care in the control arm, and that may explain why we don't see differences. Finally, it was conducted only in two state prison systems, although it does cover a fairly large proportion of incarcerated individuals in this country. So just in summary, despite a fairly intensive, non-judgmental, theory-based, multi-pronged intervention, both groups experienced a similar steady loss of pre-release viral suppression. About 60% had undetectable viral loads by 24 weeks in both imputed and complete case analysis. I don't know if that's glass half empty or glass half full, so I guess you could look at that different ways. More impact participants, 10% more, did access care within 6 weeks compared with the controls, so we did have an effect. We did have an effect there. So what are these... finally, what do these findings tell us? What are some of the implications? Well, first, it appears that linkage to a comprehensive care clinic, an HIV clinic, as we had thought, while it may reduce costs of urgent care visits, which we didn't measure specifically, alone it's insufficient when the objective is to achieve sustained suppression of HIV viremia for people being released from prison. And so that implies that more distal steps of the cascade, particularly retention and adherence, are likely quite critical, no surprise, although we sought to address these steps through our motivational interviewing and text messages, but obviously wasn't enough. So we think that likely that interventions that address the chaotic social environments, the challenges to which prisoners return in their communities, may be needed to surmount more fully the structural barriers to retention and adherence that are required. I do want to make acknowledgments, also known as a village, and as you can see, it really does take a village, as the saying goes. I want to thank my co-principal investigators, David Wall, Pat Flynn, and Kevin Knight, as well as a particular shout-out to Jessica Carter-Otten, our project manager, and Jennifer Groves and Sonia Naprovnik, who helped quite a bit with generating the data for this presentation, and the entire team, as well as the impact participants, the prisoners who participated, release prisoners who participated wholeheartedly in this study, as well as our funders. And if there's time, I'd be happy to take questions.
So we are actually not going to have time, but what I would recommend is that if you had a question, just come up here as other people are leaving. If you guys could stay back for a couple minutes, I did want to let you know that the next event is at 12:15 with the thematic orals. Lunch is a little bit later today, 1:45 to 2:45. Is that right? 2:15? I know, I just shortened your lunch, just like that. Did you see that? 1:15 to 2:45, and then we'll do another thematic orals, and we're not all back together here again until 4 p.m., where we have a few, I think, pretty exciting panels. I did want to make a programmatic change announcement. So we realized that we double-booked Laramie Smith, so the change is that at 2:45 for session one, abstract number 156, which is Smith presenting, will go first and not last, as it's currently listed. And then session three in Regency 3 should remain unchanged. Sure, that made a ton of sense. You guys need coffee. Thank you to our amazing top three abstract presenters. Thank you.